So what do we know about this equation so far? Well, we know that the equation is elliptic if d2u is positive definite. Okay, so solutions are locally uniformly convex. Elliptic solutions are locally uniformly convex. And if we want to look at the Dirichlet problem and we want to impose a condition like this on the solution, it's pretty clear that if we want to consider, say, arbitrary smooth boundary data here, we have to restrict the domains, right? We should look only at domains that are uniformly convex. Sorry? Why is it clear? Well, if you have a domain which is not convex, then there will be certain boundary values that can't be achieved by any convex function. So for example, if the domain has a flat spot on the boundary, and I make the function there look like, say, minus x squared, so it's strictly concave, because it's flat, there's no way I can get a convex solution to attain that boundary value, right? So you have to make a choice here. You either have to, you don't have much choice here. If we're going to do elliptic theory, we need this, and if we're not going to do elliptic theory, we have to look at some other equations because the Monge-Ampere equation's too hard if it's not elliptic. Okay, so you either have to look for on domains for which you want to describe arbitrary smooth boundary data and try to find conditions. So in that case, it's natural to make the domain uniformly convex. Right? Even a domain which is convex, but which has a flat spot, the boundary function is concave on the flat spot, there's no way you can solve the Dirichlet problem with a convex solution. So we should assume omega is uniformly convex. Well, if I have a domain which is like this, there is no convex function which is equal to zero on the boundary of this. Okay? So you have to make a choice here. You either look on for arbitrary smooth boundary data on a uniformly convex domain, or you have to, if you're going to look on general convex domains, then you really have to make some sort of restriction on what sort of boundary condition you can allow, what sort of boundary data. So today, I'm going to talk about the results that you get when you have a uniformly convex domain. So everything's going to be smooth. So uniformly convex means that principal curvatures of boundary omega are positive. So, particularly there's some fixed positive lower bound because the domain is bounded. Okay, we'll also assume F is smooth. So everything is smooth, positive, the boundary data, smooth, okay? So you can get away with less than this. Okay, principal curvatures. If you, right, so here's the domain, right? The boundary of that is a surface, n minus one dimensional submanifold of Rn. So locally, you can represent it as a graph. If you choose coordinates like this, for some function, and uniformly, the principal curvatures are the eigenvalues of this matrix. Tangent, yes. Okay. That's what principal curvatures are. Okay, so from what do we need to do? Well, what we need is estimates. And the estimate we need to get solvability, we need to show that the C2 alpha norm is bounded for something which will depend on the Gaussian in some way. And remember, there was actually a family of problems for which we needed to get bounds, but you can always choose the family so that all the structure, the regularity assumptions, they're all satisfied uniformly for this family. So in effect, you can just replace it by one, work with one, then you'll see that the same results are going to hold in general. So that's the estimate we want to prove. So from last time, we know, okay, well, before last time, so suppose we can prove that the second derivatives are bounded. So that means u plus du plus d2u is less than a constant in omega. Then what do we have? Well, then we have f of x u du. F is a smooth positive function, so this will have some positive lower bound, because once we've bounded this, we're taking values only over some compact set, omega bar times an closed interval in our closed bounded interval in Rn times some bound ball in Rn, right, because this is what this first part of the bound tells you. So this function is positive. Okay, so we've got, and we've got, this is bounded from above. That means that we also have some positive lower bound. Okay. This, well, the equation is determinant of the Hessian is F, right? And if I've got this, then determinant of the Hessian is down below. And if I've got an upper bound for that, and the determinant is bounded from below, then I must have a lower bound as well. Right? You can see this just by diagonalizing. It's just a product of the eigenvalues. Okay? So, which means that equation is uniformly elliptic. Once this is bounded. Okay, so once we've bounded the second derivatives, we've got a uniformly elliptic equation. Okay. Okay, and once we've got a uniformly elliptic equation, Well, if you can remember back to last week, we had the result that if you have a uniformly elliptic equation like this, with everything smooth, f uniformly elliptic and f concave implied that the 2 alpha norm, or how should I, controlled by constant plus this for some alpha between 0 and 1 depending on the ellipticity, and some controlled constant bigger than 0. So except for the fact that here we've just got x, and here we've got x udu. I mean, this result is actually true even if you have a general equation like this, uniformly elliptic, concave with respect to the second derivative variables, then you get an estimate like this. Okay, it's true in general. It's just that the proof I gave was for this simpler case. Technically, it's quite a lot more complicated, but it's still true. So, if we use that result, we can plug into here, provided we know f is concave. Then, we've got a second derivative bound, we can plug into this theory, we get a C2 alpha bound. Right? And so, we need to know f is concave. Well, so what should we take as f? Well, f of d2u is determinant of d2u. Well, if you think about it a bit, that's not concave. But if you take the logarithm of that, this is concave. If d2u is positive. Also, you could take the nth root, and that is also concave. So if you rewrite the equation a little bit, take the logarithm or the nth root of it instead of just the determinant, you've got a concave operator, and then the theory applies. Okay? Concave means that if I differentiate this twice with respect to the second derivative variables, then this should be less than or equal to 0 for all symmetric matrices eta. That's what concave means. At least that's what it means when you have a C2 function. Okay, maybe, do I need to prove this? Well, you can. On the space of symmetric positive definite matrices. Well, on Rn squared, if you like. Yeah, not much difference, really. Okay, it's a concave function. Right, I mean, if you differentiate once, you'll get the... Well, we will need it a bit later. Okay, so if you differentiate once, Fij, you're going to get the 1 over determinant times the cofactor matrix, Aij, let's say, and that divided by that is the inverse, okay? So, okay, so it's going to be, now you have to differentiate the inverse matrix. Well, Well, you can figure out what you get from using this relation, and you can check that. Right. That's what you get. Right. So. You can check the concavity now. Okay, so now we have to prove this estimate. Okay, so that part we've got, it took all the machinery of the last four lectures or so, going way back to Alexandrov maximum principle, weak Harnack inequality, Krylov's boundary gradient estimate, Evans-Krylov theory for last week. It took about four lectures to build up all the machinery for this, so most of the work is in this estimate, right? It took a lot of work to get that. The rest is, by comparison, it's still not entirely trivial, but it's easier. So that's what I wanted to describe today, at least start on it. Maybe before I do that, if you look at this equation, or possibly this one. Okay. Even if you start with something uniformly elliptic, it still reduces by the same theorem. It reduces to proving a bound for solution and its first and second derivatives. So what works in the uniformly elliptic case is somewhat simpler, but similar to what you do in the Monge-Ampere case, right? It's still sort of barrier constructions and maximum principle, things like that. It's just that the geometry of the domain becomes less important because you've got uniform ellipticity. For the Monge-Ampere equation, we're going to have to use the structure of the equation a little differently than you would in the uniformly elliptic case. So I prefer, rather than doing that, than going through same sort of arguments, but with some modification, I'll do the Monge-Ampere stuff, and then maybe if there's time later on sometime, I might come back to the uniformly elliptic case. So, good. Okay, so now we have to estimate, so the C0 estimate. Okay, so first of all, we've got a convex function. Well, a convex function has its maximum on the boundary. Convex function. We're looking at convex solutions. A convex function on some domain has its maximum on the boundary. It must be found on a bounded domain. And u is phi on the boundary, so we have this bound. Okay, so we need to get a lower bound now. Okay, so you can't get a lower bound with no with no assumptions. You need some structure, simply because you can take sequences of convex functions as big as you going down to minus infinity, and you simply choose f that makes the equation that gives you so that you have a solution, and you don't have any lower bound. You have to make some assumptions. So here's one, a structural assumption. So suppose there exists suppose f is non-decreasing and there exists some n G in L1 of omega, H in L1 log, Rn, non-negative, such that f of x, z, p is less than g of x, satisfying integral of g over omega is less than integral of h over Rn. Such that f x z p is less than g of x h p for all x in omega p in n z less than or equal to n. Then the minimum or the inf of u over omega is bigger than the inf over the boundary of phi plus n minus some constant which depends on n g h times the diameter of omega. Oh, just z less than n. Okay, then you get this bound. And, well, we've seen the proof of this already, but maybe I'll just sketch it briefly. Since it's, the proof was essentially the Aleksandrov-Bakumin maximum principle. So you look at the set omega n, where omega intersect the set where, let's see, u is less than n, u of x is less than n, and then you have determinant of v2u is on that set that's less than or equal to f of x n du, which is less than or equal to g of x this should be a ratio here. Therefore, right, by multiplying by h times du integration, we get that. Now, and this, by the change of variables form, you see this is the Jacobian of the gradient map. This is the Jacobian of the map. That you just get du of omega n h p dp. Just leave this out. On the other hand, the assumption is that this is strictly less than h of r n. So now we choose R0 so that equal to this number. Then, for any r bigger than r0, the integral over br0h is bigger, non-negative. Let's just say positive. Bigger than du omega n h, so there exists some some p which is in br0 minus du of omega n, right? What does that mean? That P is not in the gradient image of omega n. So if you draw a picture, we have this sort of situation. There is a plane of slope P. Maybe I'll draw it more like this. There's some plane of slope P which is not in the gradient image. So if we take a plane of slope P and lift it until it touches, it has to touch somewhere on the boundary. Because if it touched graph of u inside, then P would be in the gradient image. We're interested here only over this set omega n, right? So it must touch somewhere on the boundary of omega n. So at that point, what must you have? Well, if it's on the boundary of omega, it must touch at a point where u is equal to phi. So let's just say this is x0. Well, if you lift it, it will touch, it can touch somewhere, but outside this set. It can touch somewhere else. But, so, therefore, u of x by convexity is bigger than u of x0 plus p x minus x0 for all x in omega. And now you consider the cases. What are the possibilities? Either x0 is in boundary of omega, which means that u of x0 is bigger than or equal to the minimum of the boundary values, or x0 is in the set omega intersect, the set where u of x is bigger than n, which means that u of x0 must be bigger than n. Okay, so here, because it's this is graph u, this is xn plus 1 is equal to u of x0 plus p x minus x0, p dot. Okay, so there are two possibilities. Okay, either it touches on the boundary, in which case you have that, or it touches inside, but it touches where u is bigger than n. Okay, now, if you come back to here, this is in this ball BR, so this is less than or equal to R mod R, that is less than or equal to R, therefore U of X is bigger than or equal to, well, bigger than or equal to either inch, phi, boundary of omega. Maybe I should state it this way. It's probably minimum of those two. Minus R times the diameter of the domain. This is true for all x in omega. Okay. And now you let R go to R0, where R0 is this number where you have equality. Okay, so that gives you a lower bound. Okay, so it's basically the argument that went into Alexandra Bakelman. So examples, if we have just the ordinary Monge-Ampere equation, just x dependence, then we get the inf of u. Well, then we get the trivial bound by concavity, and then we get minus you get some constant depending 1 over
well, let me just say constant, depending on n, times the diameter, times the L1 norm of 1 over n.
That's the bound, right? So if you just have x dependence here, no gradient, no u, you get a bound provided this is just an L1 function. Right? Because you can take g is f, and you take h is equal to just constant function 1. And you see that the R0 you get is exactly up to some constant depending on n. It's the nth root of the integral of f. Okay, so that's one example. Another interesting example is the equation of prescribed Gauss curvature. Okay, and this, so k of x there. In this case, we take k, g is k, and h is 1 over 1 plus, so h of p is this function, right? The reciprocal of, we want to write this, remember, as g over x, h over du, so the choice is made for you, right? And so we get a bound provided we get lower bound provided integral of k of omega is less than integral of this function. Okay? And then, what is this? Well, if you look at the power, you see this is integrable. What you get is simply the volume of the unit ball, omega n. And the easiest way to see that is to look at the hemisphere. It has constant Gauss curvature 1. So, and it's the gradient image will be all of, Rn. So the integral of Gauss curvature here, which is 1, will be integral of 1 over the unit ball. You just get the measure of the unit ball, and it has to equal this integral because the gradient image is all of R n, so this integral is that. So you don't have to do anything fancy. You just need to. So you get a bound for the prescribed Gauss curvature equation, provided the integral of the curvature is strictly less than the maximum it could possibly be. Okay? Okay, so that's the C0 bounds. That's pretty easy. Now I want to say something about the gradient bounds. So any questions that reasonably clear? So you see, if you think about this Gauss curvature case, you see, if the Gauss curvature is getting close, you can have something which, a function which it looks very like that, which has huge gradient, you can stretch it out as much as you want, and just if you don't have any control on this, there's no way you're going to get a bound on the solution without using some other fact. So you see, this is sort of a necessary condition. Okay. On the other hand, you can get bounds for the solution here, even when you have something here which it can blow up very fast. But there's still other ways of getting bounds. So this is not necessarily optimal in that case. Like it's not optimal in that case. Okay, now the C1 bound. So, first of all, there's the easy part. Okay? And that is pretty obvious again from convexity. Right, the convex function has its maximum on the boundary, but also the gradient has its maximum on the boundary. And if it's not geometrically clear, here's an analytic proof. If d2u squared has an interior max, then at that point, we have the first derivative has to be zero. So it's dij dju times dijU is zero. Or if you multiply this by di, you get zero. Which means that if we have a zero eigenvalue, which means that our assumption was we've got a positive function. So that's an analytic proof if the geometry doesn't convince you. Okay. So really, for the gradient bound, the whole issue is to bound the gradient on the boundary. And okay, well, again, we need some structure conditions because you can't do it with no assumptions, right? The hemisphere, it's a bounded solution of the Gauss curvature equation. It's constant on the boundary, but the gradient is infinite on the boundary. So you need some structure to get a bound. So we assume, so remember, we've bounded the solution now. So as far as the dependence on the solution is concerned, that's just bounded. So the structure, we assume that f of x z p is bounded from above by some constant mu times distance x to the boundary of omega to some power beta times 1 plus mod p to the alpha, where, and this is for all, say, x in omega, p in Rn,
mod z less than, say, m0, which is the soup of u, which is already bounded. And these constants we have for some constants mu bigger than 0, alpha and beta bigger than or equal to 0, with alpha, with beta bigger than or equal to alpha plus n, alpha minus n minus 1. So we need this sort of structure. Okay, I'll prove a gradient bound under those assumptions. So what this is saying is, if the power of the gradient is getting too big, then you need to compensate for that by making the function decay as you get near the boundary. Okay, so as soon as alpha gets bigger than n plus 1, beta has to be positive, and you have this term here, which is forcing f to go to 0 on the boundary. So this example here, for this one to fit in, well, alpha would be n plus 2 here, so you would need beta to be at least 1. So for the Gauss curvature equation, the condition that condition becomes that simply that the Gauss curvature goes to 0 in a Lipschitz way on the boundary. Okay. Now, remember, my assumption was f positive in the closure. Okay. So this assumption here is not really compatible with that assumption unless alpha is less than or equal to n plus 1. But I want to do this, so I allow beta here, at least for the gradient bound, because I want to get some results for this as well. Well, here f is positive up to the boundary, and we're going to need positive up to the boundary for some other stuff. So so if you want to just take beta equal to 0, then you're, if beta is equal to 0, the assumption is that f x z p is simply bounded 1 plus p to the alpha to the n plus 1. Right? You can't allow a higher power than that. And this happens for uniformly elliptic equations too. If you want to look at Laplacian is equal to du, and you want to put a power in, square is critical. Powers less than a square, maybe there's some regularity issues, but let me maybe put it like this. Let me call it something else, gamma. The case where gamma is less than 2 is well behaved. Once gamma gets bigger than 2, so you've got something that grows faster than quadratically, you can't solve the Dirichlet problem in general. Right? So this is not something special to Monge-Ampère equations. This is something that has to do with
Well, you look at the radially symmetric solutions. Right. Something like this. And you see, if you get blow up on some bounded domain, if the power is too big. And the same thing happens in the Monge-Ampère case, the radially symmetric thing is this. Yes. No, it doesn't. No. So
finding constant Gauss curvature is a problem.
Well, if you want to prescribe constant positive Gauss curvature, then you cannot solve the problem for arbitrary smooth boundary values. There'll be boundary data for which it's not solvable. So at the moment I'm looking at solving for arbitrary smooth boundary data. I want to get the structure conditions that give me a result like that. And so so for the soup bound we had those conditions which have disappeared here. And there's one other condition, and that's a condition on the growth of the right-hand side with respect to the gradient. That's the other condition you need. And then you get solvability. I mean, I could do this just with no gradient, but see, the sort of the equations that are geometrically interesting do have gradients in them. I don't want to include those. Okay, so that's the structure condition. I'll get a gradient bound under those assumptions. At least I'll try to get a gradient bound. Okay, so so we have to construct a barrier. So I'll explain what that means. Let me draw a picture. So let's suppose the domain is, say, here, this is omega, and we choose some point on the boundary, let's call it x0, say, and we fix a big ball, BRY, centered at y radius r, so that this big ball touches at x0. Right, so omega is contained in B, and boundary omega intersect boundary of B is just x0. And I'm going to build a barrier by using the distance from the boundary. So D of x is going to be the distance of x to the boundary of B. So if you work it out, it's x minus y minus r. Y is the center of the ball, yes. Here somewhere. Okay, so we're going to look in a little neighborhood like this. We're going to build a barrier. So first of all, we're going to look at a barrier of this form, W. Well, we want it to equal or be to agree with the solution, or at least lie below it on the boundary. Remember, we're building a lower barrier, right? So if this is U, we want to find something that has bounded gradient and it sits below it and touches at one point here. This is W. At some point x0. Okay, so we look at something as the right boundary values phi, and then it's going to be minus psi times some function of the distance. Okay, so first, so now we compute. Then we get okay, now, we can assume phi is convex because if phi is not convex, we can add phi plus some large constant times a defining function to it. So psi is C2 on Rn, and omega is strictly uniformly convex, and omega is the set of x where psi of x is less than 0. And you can always find such a function if you have a bounded uniformly convex domain. There is a defining function which is uniformly convex. So if you add a large enough multiple of that to this, you get something that is convex. Right? Because second derivatives of this are controlled, and we're adding a large uniformly convex function. So we can assume phi is convex. Then so we just throw away, we use an inequality now, determinant of, what am I using here? I'm using that determinant of A plus B is bigger than or equal to determinant of A plus determinant of B if A and B are positive symmetric matrices. Any proof? I'll leave the details, but use concavity of get A 1 over N, and it'll come out. Okay, now we compute this. Well, it's basically a radial function. So what we get is minus the second derivative, then we get psi prime over the distance to the origin, which is x minus y, and all this is to the n minus first power. So the function is going to be chosen so that psi is concave. So minus psi double prime is positive. Psi prime is going to be positive. And x minus y is less than or equal to r, so we can just estimate that like that. No, it's not the same one as here. Maybe I call that something else.
haven't chosen psi.
No, I'm going to write it down now. Okay, I have to choose a psi that's going to give me the right properties. Okay, so we want... So what do we want? Well, we want... what we would like to get out of this, if we look at this set here, the green set, this is omega intersected the set where D is less than or equal to A. So A is that distance there, right? Let's call that omega A. What we want is, we want W convex. We want greater than or equal to f of x w dw in omega A, and we want w less than or equal to u on the boundary of omega A with w at x0 equal to u at x0. That's what we want. We want a function that has these properties. Then we have a comparison principle. Then by comparison principle, W is less than or equal to U in omega A, and because we have equality, see the pictures like this, this is U, W like this, x0. The view, the outward normal, so that gives us a bound for the normal derivative of U. That's what we want. Right? So we want U convex. We want dw to be controlled by some constant, and we want all these. And then we get that. Right? Right, so I'm just building this. A function like this is called a barrier. Right, it's a barrier because basically, at least locally, near the point where we're working, U stays on one side. So in this case, it's a lower barrier because U is always near the point, it stays above it. Okay, so we want to build a lower barrier. Okay, so so that's the idea. Now, what's the choice? Okay, well, barriers have been used in PDE theory for a long, long time. One choice that has been used a lot, I think this choice goes back to Theron, is something that looks like this, where K and D and mu are some positive constants to be chosen. So you could probably do this with some other barrier, but this one works quite nicely. So we've got three things to choose. We've got the K free, we've got the nu. Yes. Let's just say gamma. Gamma. All right, gamma. No. Gamma. Okay, gamma. Maybe I'll change this to nu. I'll stick nu there. So nu is sort of traditional. What'll I call it? I don't know. Little n. So we've got three things that we're free to adjust. We've got K, we've got the M, and we've got this A. right? We're allowed to make the domain here as small as we want. So we've got three things to fiddle with. So we can satisfy all of these. Right? So now we do some computation. So psi prime is k m 1 plus k d. Psi double prime is minus k squared m 1 plus k d all squared. Right, so the assumptions here are satisfied. I said the second derivative would be negative, which it is. Psi prime is positive, it is. So this is all okay. Okay, so now we psi is going W is here and it's going to be this is a function which is at least on this set, it's as you move away from the boundary it decreases, so we can replace that by phi, and then we can use our structure assumptions. It's less than constant mu, distance the beta, 1 plus dw the alpha, okay, which is less than or equal to mu d to the alpha. Now here I get 1 plus psi prime plus d phi to the alpha. So it's less than or equal to, say, 2 to the alpha, mu d alpha psi prime n plus 1 plus beta. Provided I can make psi prime bigger than this number. So if we plug in the choice we've made up there, we get a 2 to the alpha, we get mu k n plus 1. The beta's gone, right? Alpha is, where's alpha? Where are we? Alpha is less than beta plus n plus 1. So if we put n plus 1 plus beta here, we estimate from above, then we can cancel this beta here with this, provided, say, d times psi is less than 1. Okay, so we've got a couple of conditions we want to satisfy. Right? So this is okay provided I can satisfy these conditions. And then this, well, let me go back and Maybe that makes it clearer. Okay, so that's less than or equal to that. We put in the choice there. We get psi n plus 1. We get a k to the n plus 1. We get m to the n plus 1. 1 plus k d the n plus 1. Okay, here, on that side, we get we get a k squared from here. We get a k to the n minus 1 from there, so it's k n plus 1. Then we've got m to the n, and then we've got 1 plus k d n plus 1, and then we've got r the n minus 1. Okay, so that will be bigger than or equal to this stuff, 2 to the alpha mu k to the n plus 1 over m n plus 1, 1 plus k d n plus 1, provided we choose, say, m is equal to 1 plus 2 to the alpha r n minus 1 times mu. And if you make this choice, if you make, so at this stage we need, if you make this choice, you get that this is bigger than or equal to that. Okay? And you also get this inequality. That one's okay, because then you have kd over m times 1 plus kd, so kd over 1 plus kd is less than 1, and if m is bigger than 1, we certainly get something less than 1. So that part is okay. So we've got the first inequality up the top there, determinant of d2w is bigger than f, provided we make this choice. Okay, so we fixed m. Now we've still got the k and the a. So now we have to fix the k and the a to get the other conditions. So what do we want? We also want say W bigger than or equal to U on omega intersect the set D equal to A. So that's on this part of the boundary here. Right? We want wrong way. Less than or equal to. So now we're going to choose k and a. So so what we want, w. So w is phi minus psi d. So if we choose psi at a bigger than or equal to, say, phi is convex, remember, so it's, say, 2m0, which is the sup of u on the boundary, then we will have w is less than u on boundary, on omega intersect set where d is equal to a. Right? If we choose so large. So what does that mean? Well, we get psi is log 1 plus k. This is at a now. And then we had 1 over m. So we want that bigger than or equal to 2m0. And that's the same as, if you rearrange it, you want k a to be e to the 2m0 minus 1. Right? If you choose k and a, so they have to satisfy this relation, and then we'll have that. I'm only looking, I only need that on this boundary portion here. Okay? On the other part, on boundary omega intersect the set where d is less than a, we have w is less than or equal to phi. Okay, so there's no problem there. That part's okay. The other part is okay if we make this choice. So I haven't fixed k and a yet. I've just said what they have to satisfy. And the final choice I have to make this big. Psi prime has to be bigger than this number. Okay, so we choose. So we also need psi prime bigger than or equal to that number mu zero, which is 1 over m k 1 plus k d is bigger than or equal to mu 0. Okay, so the worst possible case is when d is a, and we know what k a is, has to be from there. Therefore, we need k bigger than or equal to, if you work it out, it's mu 0 m e to the 2m m 0. Okay, so k has to be bigger than mu 0. M 1 plus KA, which is mu 0 N e to the M 0. Right. So that's right, yeah. Okay, so if you make all those choices, you've got a lower barrier. There. So you've got a bound for the normal derivative from one side. Okay, now you need to construct an upper barrier. Upper barrier, well, that's easy. Okay, upper barrier, you can solve. Harmonic function, the the same boundary conditions. Okay, we know U is convex, so it's subharmonic. Which means that U is less than V in omega. We have equality on the boundary, which means that the outward normal derivative is bounded from below now, which is bounded by some negative constant, because this has a smooth solution. Right? And you can also get the upper, the bound from the other side, this lower bound, you can also get it by convexity, right? The slope here is controlled by, from above is controlled by the slope of that. So I think there's lots of ways of doing that part. So that's not hard. So we've got the normal derivatives controlled from above, controlled from below, and the tangential derivatives. Well, the tangential derivatives are clear because we have the boundary condition. So tangential derivatives got U is phi on the boundary, so for any tangential direction, and this is bounded. So we've got all the whole gradient bounded on the boundary, and therefore we've got the whole gradient bounded everywhere. Okay, so I don't think I'll go on to the second derivative bounds today. That will take me a little longer. Maybe just make some remarks. Here?
Yeah.
I'm comparing U. U is convex, so U is subharmonic. I definitely don't want to compare this, because I don't know that the solution of that is convex, so I don't have comparison if I try to do it that way. Okay, so what we've got so far is this problem, we've got omega uniformly convex, we've got under some structure conditions. Okay, so once we've got that, then we've got determinant, then we've got f of x u du. This is also bounded now, and it's bounded from above and below. So now we're in the setting where the right-hand side is bounded between two constants. Okay, and now we don't need it. Now there's no more structure, because we've used all the structure there is. There's nothing more, apart from the structure of the determinant, which we'll use, but the right-hand side, we don't need any more structure now. Now, in some cases, so sometimes there exists a subsolution that U bar in say C2 omega bar convex is determinant D2 U underlined is bigger than f of x u du in omega. So sometimes you assume you have such a thing, sometimes you can construct it. In that case, in this case, comparison principle implies that u bar is less than or equal to u in omega, which implies all the estimates that I've done up till today. Because this is a lower barrier, and a global lower barrier, not just local. So, and if you have such a function, then you get the estimates for the solution and the gradient basically for free. You can construct a subsolution on omega uniformly convex if f of x z p is less than constant say 1 plus p to the n. Okay, so this was things like that were constructed. Well, I think the first one to construct this was Pierre Lyons about 20 years ago. So if you can do that on a uniformly convex domain, you can do that on a uniformly convex domain. So at least for this, once you have such a subsolution, you get these estimates for free. Okay, so if you don't want to, if instead of assuming structure, you assume you've got a subsolution, you don't have to do much work. Okay. Okay, so next time I'll explain how the second derivative bounds works.